wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So this week on Dear Science, we've got quite the range of topics. And we're starting off this week with a chat about mayflies. So what's the deal with mayflies and why are they so important when it comes to ecosystems?
Well, mayflies, but really just insects in general. So I think we're all familiar with, you know, if you leave a window open at night and you've got lights on, you tend to attract lots of flies who swarm around the light. And this is on a global scale, this is an effect that is actually severely impacting insect populations worldwide. Each summer, for instance, on bridges, so this is the mayfly example, each summer on bridges across the world, the first warm weather prompts the transformation of the insect's aquatic larvae. And within hours, these short-lived flying adults sort of pop out of the streams and start to fly around and mate and lay eggs by the millions or billions. But bridges tend to be illuminated, and a lot of these artificial lights can lure the emerging adults away from the water and lead to death before they're able to breed. Others that are fooled by the sort of the sheen of reflective pavements drop their eggs on the bridge, on the road instead of the water. And because mayflies control the growth of algae and are food for fish, the fate of these insects tends to reverberate throughout ecosystems. So this is an issue that is worth looking at. Some studies from around the globe are finding some worrisome impacts on insect mating and abundance. Some researchers say brighter nights might be a factor in documented insect declines. So insect numbers are dropping by 80% in some places, and about 40% of insect species are heading for extinction by some estimates. And even as they raise the alarm, scientists are starting to point at some fairly simple solutions. So mounting, for instance, the mayfly example, mounting bright lights low on the side of bridges, keeping the mayflies close to the water would help them. It would stop them flying over onto the bridge and then potentially wasting their eggs or dying. Obviously, many insects and other animals are drawn to light at night because they depend on the moon or the sun for navigation. And light at night is increasing by up to about 40% per year. This is becoming a global, brighter planet at nighttime. Cities are using more LEDs with blue light that's brighter than the yellow glow of the sodium vapor, the old street lamps that were quite yellow. And on moonless nights, artificial sky glow now exceeds the combined light of stars and other natural sources on about 22% of the landmass, global landmass. So a lot of the world, you can't now see the stars.
Jeez,
at night.
That's crazy.
Yeah, thankfully, not so much in New Zealand, but big cities around the world, that's absolutely true. So another example, Germany's got maybe 9-10 million street lights, and they attract, by some estimates, about 1 billion insects every night, many of which die or are killed by bats or other predators that know to expect lots of insects around light sources. And researchers have estimated that at least a third of the insects swarming around artificial lights are due to die of exhaustion or are just eaten by predators. So there's a recent study underscores the magnitude of this effect. On one night, this was in July 2019 in Las Vegas, the glow of the lights lured a huge number of migrating grasshoppers into the air above the city. And the cloud, there's so big a number of grasshoppers, the cloud was visible on weather radar.
Jeez,
so they could see this cloud
insane.
Of swarming grasshoppers that were swarming there because of the lights. At its peak, the swarm weighed, the estimate from the radar, about 30 tons and contained 48 million grasshoppers. So there was more grasshoppers in the air on that single July night than human visitors to Las Vegas in a whole year.
Wow.
And many of those would have been killed or lost to predators or unable to breed.
There definitely would have been a field day for any bird that was around.
Absolutely. So in the Netherlands, there's a consortium of university, non-profits, industry and government that that are starting to explore light's effect on local ecosystems and trying to set up long-term experiments to study this. But there's very little actually being done to reduce lights at night. In some places, dimmer, sort of redder lights are being tested. So there's an example in the Grand Teton National Park in the U.S., they're trialing these redder, slightly dimmer lights, but the data is not in yet, and much more ambitious measures are needed for the sake of insects and their ecosystems.
It's crazy. Is there, like, I know it's a little bit off track with this piece, but is there anything for New Zealand? I mean, we've got a huge insect population, seeing as we're sort of all about insects and birds here.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing about New Zealand in this article, but I know that generally New Zealand has darker skies than many other places. So in that sense, we are doing probably better. But obviously, you know, Auckland sky at night in the middle of Auckland, you're not going to see many stars. No. There is plenty of lights in the big cities.
Yeah. Okay, so looking at our next story today, we're looking at Australian superhighways that would have existed thousands of years ago, and using supercomputers to map them out, it just sort of blows my mind really that we can actually do this.
Yeah, this is quite an interesting thing that I found. So humans set foot in Australia at least 65,000 years ago, and they got to Australia across a land bridge from Papua New Guinea. So the sea levels were lower. There was dry land between Papua New Guinea and northern Australia, and humans were able to migrate across. And when they got there, they faced this task of navigating a landscape they'd never seen before. This was completely new. And so researchers have wondered about the routes that humans took across Sahul, which is what they've called the landmass that connected Australia, New Guinea, and actually Tasmania as well, before the islands were separated by rising seas about 20,000-ish years ago, at the end of the last ice age. Many researchers think that ancient people used boats to cross from Asia, but the routes that they walked once they reached the land have never really been obvious.
Yeah.
You know, how did they sort of migrate across that massive landmass? And so they wanted to try and reconstruct those early travelers' paths or potential paths. And so what they did was that they assembled the first detailed topographic maps of Sahul, which is this sort of supercontinent, includes Papua New Guinea and Tasmania, including past coastal lands that are now underwater. And they did this using satellite and aerial undersea mapping data. And then they turned to a computational technique called least cost path analysis. And this was used to calculate optimal walking routes across this sort of recreated landscape. And the calculations are analogous to pouring digital water on a virtual landscape and watching where it flows. Where's the sort of the path of least resistance that these people would follow? And in this case, the researchers created an imaginary traveler. This was they imagined a 25-year-old woman carrying 10 kilograms of supplies and sent her on literally billions of journeys across this giant landmass. And their simulations calculated how many calories she would have burnt while walking each route, as well as which paths would have provided a reliable supply of water based on what they knew about the lakes and rivers and springs that existed in Australia at that time. And they also simulated what the traveler would have seen as she walked, noting prominent landmarks like craggy outcrops and prominent ridges and things like that, and she could have used those as navigational aids. And this was a gigantic computational task. It took weeks to run these complicated simulations on a supercomputer operated by the U.S. government. But ultimately, this computation revealed a network of optimal sort of superhighways that had the most attractive combinations of easy walking and water and good landmarks so that they could navigate. And so they had this roadmap. After all these calculations, they had this roadmap in their hands, and they faced a sort of a fundamental question. Is this actually what happened? Is there any evidence that real people had once used these sort of corridors, these computer identified corridors? And so to find out, they compared their routes to the locations of about 36 archaeological sites in Australia, known to be about at least 35,000 years old. And remarkably, many of the sites sat on or very close to those superhighways. And some of the corridors also coincided with ancient trade routes known from indigenous oral histories, or aligned with genetic and linguistic studies used to trace early human migrations. So it seems like what they'd figured out from these computational modeling may be close to what actually happened.
That's insane.
Yeah, and it's potentially really useful because it also highlighted migration corridors that hadn't really been studied before, and which could in the future at least yield archaeological discoveries. So, for example, some early highways sat on coastal lands that are now submerged, so they could give marine researchers a guide for exploration of those areas. And even better, the authors say that the major routes got across several arid areas in Australia's centre and in the northeastern state of Queensland, and those paths challenge a long-standing view that the earliest people tended to avoid the deserts in the middle of Australia. They tended to go around the edges. But it seems like this from these computational studies that perhaps they went across.
Wow.
Yeah. So the future for this sort of work, you know, they're hoping that they could use these techniques to map migration routes across other continents, including, for example, North America. So when people came across over the sort of Siberian
Land bridge
sort of into Alaska, what happened then? And so they could do the same sort of analysis. Trouble is, it takes a lot of computation to do this.
Yeah.
And they've got to be prepared for that.
Yeah. And then lastly, we're talking about COVID-19, and we've got a little update on transmission and how the vaccine impacts that.
Yeah, very briefly. So it seems like a single dose of the COVID-19 vaccine made by either Pfizer, which is the one I think we're getting in New Zealand, or AstraZeneca, cuts a person's risk of transmitting COVID-19 to their closest contacts by about 50%. So it cuts it by about a half. And this is according to analysis of more than 360,000 households in the UK. Although the vaccines have been shown to reduce COVID-19 symptoms and serious illness, their ability to prevent coronavirus transmission has been pretty unclear to date. And so these researchers look for cases in which someone had become infected with COVID-19 after receiving a dose of either vaccine. And then they assessed how often those individuals transmitted the virus to household contacts. And so the team found that people who had been vaccinated for at least 21 days could still test positive for the virus, but viral transmission from these individuals to others in their households was 40 to 50% lower than transmission in households in which the first person to test positive had not been vaccinated. And the results for those two vaccines, the Pfizer and the AstraZeneca vaccines, were very similar. This has not yet been peer-reviewed.
Well, it's a good start.
It's a
very good start.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll see some developments with the other vaccines that are getting put out as well.
So go get vaccinated.
Yes, go get vaccinated as soon as you get given the opportunity. Sweet. That's all we've got for Dear Science this week. Thank you so much, Marcus.
You're very welcome.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.